Hi, Max.
Hi, Allison.
I love that sticker. Where did you get it?
Oh my gosh. I'm a part of the sticker club on the Patreon.
How do I join?
At the $5 level at patreon.com/UrsulaMajor. Not only do you get to see the behind the scenes contributor blog, but you join the sticker of the month club.
Oh yeah. Where is that website again?
patreon.com/UrsulaMajor.
Fabulous. Hey, everyone.
Hi, and welcome to
The Bitchery of History.
My name's Max.
I'm Allison.
And this week, I'm going to be talking about Mary Pickford.
I am going to be talking about May Edward Chin.
Ooh, all right. Now, Mary Pickford was born Gladys Louise Smith on April 8th, 1892 in Toronto, Canada. So, already know I love her. She's Canadian.
Mm-hmm.
Her parents were John Charles Smith and Charlotte Hennessy. Her father, an alcoholic, died in 1898 from a fatal blood clot, which was caused by a workplace accident when he worked on the Niagara steamship.
Hmm.
After her father died, her mother started taking on boarders, including a theatrical stage manager.
Ooh.
He suggested that Gladys take up theater, and at age 7, she had her first roles in a production of The Silver Knight with a local Toronto theater group. She acted in many melodramas with Toronto's Valentine Company and eventually got the starring role of Little Eva in a play adaptation of Uncle Tom's Cabin.
Oh, wow.
By the early 1900s, everyone in the family was involved in the theater. Mary, her mother, and her two younger siblings toured the U.S. by train, performing in third-rate companies and plays. They traveled around for 6 years, at which point she decided that if she didn't land a role on Broadway during the next summer, she would quit acting altogether.
Mm.
In 1906, Mary and her younger siblings Lottie and Jack got supporting roles in the Broadway show Edmund Burke, and then Mary, as Gladys, landed a supporting role in the play The Warrens of Virginia.
Ooh.
The play was written by William C. DeMille, whose brother was Cecil.
Oh,
DeMille.
Wow.
William C. and Cecil B. One of the producers of The Warrens of Virginia insisted that Gladys change her name to Mary Pickford. She chose the name actually by looking through a family tree.
Hmm.
After the play ended, Mary was again out of work, and then in April 1909, the Biograph Company director D.W. Griffith brought her in for a screen test for a role in a Nickelodeon film, Pippa Passes. Now, this is not Nickelodeon, the
right.
TV channel. This is the small little 5-cent movies.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Even though she did not get that role, Griffith was fascinated with Mary and decided to bring her on to his production company anyway. Most actors of the day earned about $5 a day, but after working for one day, Griffith agreed to pay her $10, securing
Whoa.
Her $40 a week. She played all kinds of roles while working at Biograph. Instead of her work there, I played scrub women and secretaries and women of all nationalities. I decided that if I could get into as many pictures as possible, I'd become known, and there would be a demand for my work.
Smart.
She was in 40 films in 1909.
Oh my gosh.
Of course, this is when films were
right.
like 5 minutes long.
Right.
In January 1910, she traveled with the company to Los Angeles, and many production companies at the time were based actually on the East Coast, but would travel to the West during winter so that they can continue filming.
Mm-hmm.
At the time, actors were not credited in Biograph films,
mm.
but Mary made an impression on audiences, and she was quickly recognizable within weeks of her first appearance. Exhibitors of Biograph's film would actually capitalize on her popularity by putting signs outside of their venues saying, "The girl with the golden curls, Blondie Locks, or the Biograph girl."
Hmm.
She left Biograph briefly in 1910, but returned in 1910, not satisfied with the creative standards of other companies.
Hmm.
However, she did make her last Biograph picture in 1912. It was called The New York Hat. And we'll actually look for some of these Nickelodeons and see if we can't post them to our various social
cool.
media sites. In 1913, then, she decides to exclusively work in film. The year before, Adolf Zucker had formed Famous Players and Famous Plays, a production company that would later be known as Paramount Pictures, one of the first American feature film companies and the oldest working film studio in Hollywood that still exists.
Wow.
Zucker's plan for his production company was to record famous theater actors in replicas of their most famous stage roles. Pickford joined Zucker after her role in A Good Little Devil. And Zucker decided to make it into a film in 1913, but actors just reciting their lines into the camera was very awkward, and Pickford called it one of the worst features I ever made. It was deadly. By this point in time, though, Mary Pickford had attracted a following, especially with the comedy drama Hearts Adrift. This movie was so popular, she actually asked for a pay raise based on the profits and reviews, and it also marked the first time that Pickford's name was featured above the title on movie marquees.
Oh, wow.
A rarity for any actor of the time, not just women. 5 weeks after Hearts Adrift came out, Tess of Storm Country was released. A biographer of Pickford said that the film actually sent her career into orbit and made her the most popular actress in America, if not the world.
Mm.
In a February 1916 issue of Photoplay, Pickford was described as luminous tenderness in a steel band of gutter ferocity. She and Charlie Chaplin were the most popular actors of the day.
Mm.
And actually, Pickford was even considered the most famous woman in the entire world. In 1916, later that year, Pickford signed a contract with Zucker that granted her full authority over production of the films in which she starred.
Wow.
And received a record-breaking salary of $10,000 a week.
Whoa.
In 1916.
Holy buckets.
That's like a couple hundred thousand these days a week.
Dang.
When her contract with Zucker expired in 1918, she actually refused his terms for re-upping it and briefly went to work for First National Pictures, which, side note, is the company that worked where Warner Brothers is now in Burbank.
Mm.
First National Pictures used to be on that lot,
and okay.
Warner Brothers bought it from them. And then in 1919, Mary Pickford, her husband, Douglas Fairbanks, D.W. Griffith, and Charlie Chaplin banded together to form a production company called United Artists. Mm-hmm. Not only could Mary produce and perform in her own films, but she could also choose how to distribute them. United Artists, so quick side note, they actually broke the tradition of vertically integrated movie studios who not only produced their films, but also formed their own movie theater chains. So they had complete control over films from its inception to its theater bookings.
Mm-hmm.
United Artists was only a distribution company, which gave independent filmmakers more choice and options for theaters in which to show their films. A concept which still exists to this day. In fact, it is the majority of how it exists to this day. Because of her position as a producer at United Artists, and since she was acting in her own films, Mary Pickford became the most powerful woman who worked in Hollywood, and to this day is considered one of the most, if not the most, powerful woman who has ever worked in Hollywood.
Yeah.
Over the course of the 1920s, Mary would perform and produce many films, including Pollyanna and Rosita, both of which grossed over $1 million.
Wow.
In the 1920s. In a copy of a 1924 photoplay, she was praised by journalist Herbert Howe, and he said, "No role she can play on the screen is as great as the role she plays in the motion picture industry. Mary Pickford, the actress, is completely overshadowed by Mary Pickford, the individual."
Mm.
She helped establish the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences in 1927, which, of course, does the Oscars
of
these
course.
Days. And then in 1929, she was the star in Coquette, a movie which required her to cut off her famous ringlets and into a bob. Her fans were shocked at this transition. Her hair had become a symbol of female virtue, and made when she cut it, she made the front page of the New York Times. That's how big a deal it was. The movie was a huge success, and Mary Pickford became the second actress ever to win an Academy Award for Best Actress. Her next film, The Taming of the Shrew, which she made with her husband Douglas Fairbanks, was not well received at the box office, and Mary Pickford and other silent era movie actors actually panicked as the popularity of the talkies grew.
Mm.
On March 29th, 1928, a widely listened to radio show, which was called The Dodge Brothers, was actually broadcasted from Mary Pickford's bungalow and featured movie stars like herself, Fairbanks, Charlie Chaplin, Norma Talmadge, Gloria Swanson, and John Barrymore, amongst others, to prove that they could meet the challenge of talking movies.
Mm.
Unfortunately, the transition from talkie to silent came when Pickford was in her late 30s, and with her not being able to rely on playing the children or teenage spitfires and feisty young woman that launched her career, her star began to fade. In 1933, she underwent her first Technicolor screen test for an animated and live-action version of Alice in Wonderland by Walt Disney. But the project was actually scrapped when Paramount beat them to it.
Mm.
Mary Pickford retired from acting in 1933, and her last film, Secrets, was the last one she ever acted in.
Mm.
However, she did continued to produce. So she produced movies such as Sleep My Love in 1948, which starred Claudette Colbert, and Love Happy, which was made in 1949 with the Marx Brothers.
Hmm.
Personally, Mary was married to one man, Owen Moore, before Fairbanks. Moore was a silent film actor, but he was an alcoholic and actually abusive to Mary. She married Fairbanks only days after she divorced Moore. And Fairbanks and her conflicting schedules in the 30s led to a relationship strain. And when his affair went public, they divorced in 1936. In 1937, she married Buddy Rogers, who was another actor. And they were unable to have children, so they actually adopted two children. So near the end of her life, Mary actually withdrew into herself. She retired from the screen and turned to alcohol, unfortunately. Alcoholism actually ran in her family, and both of her siblings, Lottie and Jack, actually died of alcohol-related causes. She withdrew herself and allowed only few visitors at Pick Fair, and by the 1960s, she was only talking to guests via telephone. In 1976, Mary Pickford received an Academy Honorary Award for her lifetime of achievement, and then on May 29th, 1979, Mary Pickford died in Santa Monica after suffering a cerebral hemorrhage. She is buried in the Garden of Memory at the Forest Lawn Memorial Park in Glendale.
Wow.
An amazing woman.
Amazing.
Who
amazing.
Shaped the industry substantially that we both work in.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And it's always neat, I think, to similar almost to Joan of Arc. Like, oh yeah, I know that name, but you don't know the full story until you get really down into it.
Absolutely.
So May Edward Chin was born on April 15th, 1896 in Great Barrington, Massachusetts. Her father, Lulu Ann, was the daughter of a Chickahominy Native American and a slave. And her father, William Lafayette, was a former slave from the Chin Plantation who had escaped when he was 11. So Chin attended a boarding school in New Jersey called the Bordentown Manual and Training Industrial School. She attended just briefly because she then became ill with osteomyelitis of the jaw. It's an infectious inflammatory bone disease. And she went to stay with her mother, who was a live-in cook for Charles Tiffany. The jewelry magnate.
Yeah.
That Tiffany. That one. The Tiffanys treated her like family and took her to classical music concerts in New York. She learned how to play piano and actually became the accompanist to popular singer Paul Robeson in the early 20s. And she also performed for African American soldiers during World War I.
Wow.
And despite never finishing high school, she was admitted to Columbia's Teachers College based on her entrance exam scores. She originally planned to pursue a degree in music and become a music teacher, but she soon abandoned music for science.
Wow.
And there are a couple of kind of apocryphal stories for her switch. Apparently, one music professor told her that African Americans were unsuited for classical music and ridiculed her. And then another professor praised her for a paper that she had written on sewage disposal and encouraged her to pursue a degree in science. And she did write in her autobiography that faculty told her, because she was of African descent, quote, that unless I could afford to go to Europe for final polishing in my music, I would probably end up singing in a cabaret in America.
Wow.
If I chose science, my chances were better for a good future.
Yeah.
End quote. In 1921, she received her bachelor's degree in science from Columbia's Teachers College. And in 1926, she became the first African-American woman to graduate from Bellevue Hospital Medical College.
Whoa, cool.
During her last year, she secured a full-time position as a lab technician in clinical pathology. So she completed all of her schoolwork at night after work.
Wow.
After graduating from medical school, she soon discovered that no hospital would allow her to practice. In one case, she was seriously considered by the Rockefeller Institute for a research fellowship until they found out she was African American. Because of her lighter skin and last name, they had assumed that she was white or Chinese. She would later say that other African American workers would also snub her because they assumed that she was trying to pass as white.
Dang, can't win in any direction.
I know. She was the first black woman intern at Harlem Hospital in New York. However, racial and gender discrimination kept her from obtaining hospital privileges. So early in her practice, she would often have to see her patients in their homes. She later said in an interview for the New York Times that, quote, conditions were so bad that it seemed you were not making any headway.
Oh, geez.
End quote. She was the first woman while at the Harlem Hospital to participate in ride-alongs with paramedics on ambulance calls.
Oh, wow.
This is in the 20s. Yeah. So, you know, here we go. Let's make an ambulance.
Right.
In 1928, Chin opened her own private practice and worked with other African-American physicians at the Edgecombe Sanitarium mm-hmm. for non-white patients. And this was the start of her interest in early cancer diagnosis, as many of her patients were very ill with terminal and late-stage cancers.
Okay. All right.
In 1933, she earned another degree in public health from Columbia University, so she would be more able to treat her patients in their homes, many of whom were non-white, they were low income. In the early 30s, she studied cytological methods for cancer detections with George Papadimoulou, who was best known for his work on the Pap smear test. It's probably why we call it the Pap smear and not the Papadimoulou super long name to detect cervical cancer. Of course, very routine procedure now. She helped him further develop the test to detect the cancer early on. Through all of this, she became very interested in learning about cancer and, of course, detecting it at early stages, but she still faced prohibitions from establishing formal affiliations with New York hospitals. So she had her patients' biopsies read secretly for her at Memorial Hospital. She would also accompany her patients to their clinic appointments, telling the hospital that she was the family physician.
Oh.
By doing this, she was able to learn more about biopsy technique while securing a firm diagnosis of her patients.
Wow.
I mean, what good a on lady. Her.
Yeah.
Oh, that's how the game is played? Exactly. I know what I'm going to do. Well, that's fine. Right. Do it your way.
I'm going to change the game by playing by the rules.
All right. In 1944, she was invited by Dr. Elise Strong L'Espérance to join the staff of the Strong Clinic, a cancer detection clinic that was affiliated with Memorial and New York Infirmary Hospitals, and she worked there for 29 years and became a member of the Society of Surgical Oncology.
Whoa.
In 1975, she founded a group to promote black women who attended medical school, and in 1980, Columbia University awarded her an honorary doctorate of science for her contributions to medicine. She also received an honorary doctorate from New York University.
Whoa, cool.
Right? And she died on December 1st, 1980 at age 84.
That's amazing. Doing what you have to get by.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Absolutely amazing. Thank you so much. That's an amazing story.
Of course. I love stories like that because I read a lot of books on science and on medicine and math and all these
quantum
different things.
Quantum theory.
Yeah, because it's fascinating stuff.
Right, it is.
But so many of these authors, they will say, you know, it takes this person doing a little research in this area and this person looking at this one thing until it all comes to a head and there's a breakthrough. So it's important to remember even something as simple as, okay, I'm going to work on just detecting cancer earlier and work on the screenings.
Right.
Can then have a huge impact years and years down the line.
It's the reason why when people say, why do I need to know math? Or why do I need to know science? Or why do I need to know all these things that you have to learn in school? It's because you never know where something's going to come from.
Yeah, you need to be informed.
Absolutely.
The Bitchery of History is brought to you by Audible.com.
You can download a free book and start your free trial by going to audibletrial.com/bitchery.
This week, I'm going to recommend a book that sounds really awesome to me. It's called My Glory Was I Had Such Friends, a memoir by Amy Silverstein. Now get this, this is the story. So 26 years after receiving her first heart transplant, Amy Silverstein's donor heart plummeted into failure. So if she wanted to live, she had to take on the grueling quest for a new heart immediately. A shot at survival meant uprooting her life and moving across the country to California. When her friends heard of her plans, there was only one reaction. I'm there.
Oh my
God. Nine remarkable women, Joy, Jill, Leah, Jody, Lauren, Robin, Valerie, Anne, and Jane, put demanding jobs and pressing family obligations on hold to fly across the country and be by Amy's side.
Oh my God.
Why is this not an HBO series? Don't make Big Little Lies. Make this make me feel good.
Oh my God, that sounds absolutely amazing.
Right?
And I'm weeping already.
It sounds beautiful. So My Glory Was I Had Such Friends by Amy Silverstein.
So not only can you support Amy Silverstein in downloading her book, but you can support us as well by going to audibletrial.com/bitchery.
Mm-hmm.
Hey y'all. If you are enjoying The Bitchery of History, do Allison and myself and the rest of the team a favor and go to Podomatic, Stitcher, Google Play Music, iTunes, Apple Podcasts, and give this podcast a rating or a review. Those ratings and reviews, they help other people find this podcast, which helps us keep doing the podcast. Help us spread the word of these amazing women. Thanks. Today in history, July 24th, 1868, Marie Gugue Poucheline founded the Association Internationale des Femmes, the first women's organization in Switzerland. It was concerned with women's rights and peace. And I'm so sorry if I pronounced that name.
On July 25th, 2007, Pratibha Patil was sworn in as India's first female president.
Yes. And then on July 28th, 1866, by a vote of Congress, Vinnie Rheim receives a commission from the U.S. government for a statue of Abraham Lincoln. She was the first and, at the age of 18, the youngest woman to receive such a commission.
Is that the Lincoln Memorial? We need to research this.
Yes, we do. Coming soon to an episode of The Bitchery of History. All right, so term of the week. I think we've touched on this before, but I think it's really important that we keep having this conversation about being politically correct. What does it mean? How is it being misdefined? And how do you correctly employ it?
Oh, so all the thoughts, so many things. I think it is correctly applied when you are using it earnestly and honestly to try and have a fuller discussion.
Yes.
I would say one of the most amazing applications I have seen of it was not when someone was trying to be, probably not even trying to be politically correct or going, oh, male person, fire woman, whatever. Because I think I've talked about how I think that's ridiculous. Right. Rachel Briley, one of our teachers at UNCG as well, I took a puppetry class from her where we were building puppets. And she was saying, you know, if people need supplies, put together a list. She's happy to go to a craft store and purchase some supplies if there were things that we needed that weren't in the scene shop. And I forget who it was, but one of the students in the class said, I need some skin-colored paint. And without missing a beat, Rachel goes, okay, what color skin do you need? Like dark? Do you want like peachy skin? Do you want brown skin? What color skin? She did not assume that meant white or that meant cream or that meant some variation on a white skin tone.
A Eurocentric skin tone.
She immediately said, okay, what does that mean to you?
Right.
Not even taking the stand that this person who, if my memory serves, was white, was also coming from this point of view.
Right.
You know, it could be, oh, I need alien skin color. I need it to be green.
Right.
And that moment has just stayed with me for years because it wasn't something that seemed forced.
Right.
It was an honest, okay, well, what do you mean by skin tone?
Right.
And rather than making a big deal out of it, it was just a natural part of the conversation of you need this product to complete your puppet project. I need to know how you see this puppet being created so that I can support that.
My definition of political correct is, you know, you can have a full and earnest discussion about any topic in the entire world without having to disparage someone's race, ethnicity, or life experience, or their creation, like who they are as a person. And so I think it gets misrepresented as being politically correct is you can't say anything that I disagree with. And that is such a mistake, because it's not that I don't want you saying things that I don't agree with. In fact, I invite you to disagree with me so that we can have a conversation about it.
Mm-hmm.
It is instead using terminology that correctly represents the things and the people that we are talking about, the things and the experiences that we're talking about. So if we're talking about, for example, making a joke, a politically correct joke for me is not a joke in which no one curses. It's not a joke in which you're not, you know, effectively maybe making fun of someone, but I think it's making fun of someone without attacking their heritage or without attacking their religion or without attacking, you know, who they are at their core, which I think is there's plenty of comedy that can be made out of that.
Have I told you to watch the Netflix comedy stand-up special?
Which?
A Broad Understanding with Veer Das?
No.
You guys, major plug. I am not paid by him. I am not paid by Netflix, but it's an incredible stand-up routine, and I've watched it twice already. Wow. It's only about an hour long, hour five. It's really cool. He does the same stand-up routine once in New Delhi and once in New York, mm-hmm. and they kind of intercut the two. Right. And there's some great, hilarious stand-up moments that are really funny, but then he makes just amazing political points about race and about gender and relationships and 2017 and right. what are we all doing and, right. And these sorts of things. And I just highly yeah. recommend it.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think that's part of it too, is you can make these jokes, but being politically correct should never be the joke.
Yeah. In terms of comedy, I think it's also, if you say, you know, it was just a joke, or it was just, you know, don't mm-hmm. be political. You are effectively silencing outrage mm-hmm. or that is either rational or proper.
Mm-hmm.
It is perfectly acceptable for people to be upset about a joke that you made.
Mm-hmm.
And instead of saying, no, stop being politically correct and trying to silence me, instead you can say, oh, that's interesting. I don't think that's offensive, but let's talk about it and see where you're coming from so that maybe I can modify the joke or I mm-hmm. can modify my speech so that maybe I can still get my point across without... Allison's mic just fell over. Without...
Max was very excited making his point.
That's true. I was shaking the table. Without disparaging someone.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what I mean?
Absolutely.
I'd like to touch on safe spaces
mm-hmm.
and what a safe space is.
Sure.
Because I think what's getting lost in the conversation around safe spaces, and this also has a little bit to do with what a trigger warning is,
mm-hmm.
a safe space is where someone, it's not where, again, it's not a space where someone is going to avoid completely any information or any ideas or beliefs that they don't want to hear. That is not the intention of a safe space. The intention of a safe space is to create a space in which conversation and dialogue can be formed without people feeling like they are personally being attacked for mm-hmm. holding whatever views or beliefs mm-hmm. that they have. Or in the terms of trigger warnings, if people have gone through significantly traumatizing events in their personal histories,
mm-hmm.
creating a space in which that person feels safe to either talk about or to exist in which that history does not negatively affect them.
Exactly.
And I think saying that a safe space is simply so that snowflake liberals or snowflake conservatives don't get accosted with ideas or beliefs that are different from their own is damaging.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's damaging not only to people who actually need safe spaces, but it's also damaging college. You're supposed to hear things that you don't agree with. That is what college is for.
That's
what life is for. And if you don't learn how to interact with people you don't agree with, What are you going to do in your life? You're just going to lock yourself in a bubble all day?
I guess.
Political correctness has a place, but I think it's being misdefined or undefined the wrong way for a long time.
I'd agree with that.
It's usually politicians trying to get their
point across.
Their point across, exactly, while being inflammatory.
Yeah.
All right. I'm sure we'll come back to this eventually, but let's talk about our cause of the week.
I think it's wrapped up into every discussion that we have.
Absolutely.
Our cause of the week is Girls Not Brides. It's a global partnership of more than 700 civil society organizations from over 90 countries committing to ending child marriage and enabling girls to fulfill their potential. There are members based throughout Africa, Asia, the Middle East, Europe, and the Americas. They share the conviction that every girl has the right to lead the life that she chooses, and that by ending child marriage, we can achieve a safer, healthier, and more prosperous future for all. Stronger Together, Girls Not Brides members bring child marriage to global attention, build an understanding of what it will take to end child marriage, and call for the laws, policies, and programs that will make a difference in the lives of millions of girls.
That's amazing. Child marriage is one of the worst things that happens right now.
Mm-hmm. It is just girlsnotbrides.org.
All right. Well, The Bitchery of History is a production of Ursula Major Productions.
You can find us on all forms of social media at UMPBOH, or just search The Bitchery of History, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. We gotcha.
You can also find us at UMPBOH.com, where you will find our brand new shop where you can buy our stickers.
Woohoo!
Yes, more merchandise to come.
We could not do this podcast without our amazing team. Olivia.
Steph.
Kim.
Dan.
Jeanette.
Jess,
Keegan, and Sydney.
Yes, Sydney.
Woohoo! And as always, bitches get stuff done.